As the first plane load of Australian aid heads to Indonesia, the fate of thousands of people remains unknown following last week's devastating earthquake and tsunami.
Beyond Palu, there is still a fairly critical situation. Many of those villages that have been cut off, still badly damaged and with no way to get help in or out apart from the air.
Totally flattened buildings and chaos and fear and aftershocks is just bringing back so many memories, terrible memories that I had in Bandar Aceh.
That's me, Tim Costello, speaking from Palu. I was just there. I've just returned from Indonesia, and it's absolutely devastating. In this episode, we'll hear some first-hand accounts from the ground in Sulawesi, Indonesia, where a massive emergency relief effort is underway. A devastating earthquake, which triggered a powerful tsunami, hit the region, killing more than 2,000 people. Many were buried under rubble, screaming for help as rescuers raced against time to save them. Unfortunately, that's where many of them died. Thousands more are missing, likely dead. Homes were swallowed up by the ground. Children ripped out of their mother's arms and swept away by 6 meter high waves. And entire neighborhoods were buried under landslides. Survivors are trying to piece their lives back together as they search through rubble, one bit at a time. Here are some of their stories.
We were at home when the earthquake happened. It was shaking a lot and the floor fell through. We all tried to run, but we couldn't and just fell on the ground.
We were running until Imam Bonjol Street when the tsunami came over the rooftops. Some were saved and others weren't.
I'm so sorry.
As I travel around Palu and out, the scale of the devastation just shocked me. I had seen similar scenes in Bandar Aceh with the Boxing Day tsunami, just the terror and force of the wave. And here, it was not just a tsunami, but it was an earthquake. And not just an earthquake, but land that slipped and slid and mud called liquefaction that rose, choking families and kids. So this terrible force of nature with disaster upon disaster really was quite devastating to witness. Here is Brianna Piazza from World Vision, one of our first people on the ground after the earthquake and tsunami hit.
I was in Palu just a few days ago, actually, and I met Lista. So she lives in a place called Lere, which is a suburb of the city of Palu, which is in Sulawesi, Indonesia. And I was walking along the foreshore and I noticed this woman, Lista, and her sister, Masria, with a red bucket. And they were among the rubble sorting through what I found out was their home. And they were basically trying to find items that they could salvage and collect and take with them. But unfortunately, they didn't find anything that could be used again.
People were at the beach selling fish. They didn't have the chance to run. While other people were safe, they climbed up the coconut trees. When the tsunami arrived, we heard a loud noise. When it happened, my brother-in-law was praying in the mosque that's now flooding. The floor of the mosque was ripped out and his body wasn't recovered. I was running but turned back because I thought there was no tsunami. I tried to look for my child, and when I found her, the tsunami came. I also knew Aisha and Echi, who were selling fish at the bridge. Both of them didn't run away because they didn't think a tsunami would happen. But where they were standing collapsed. When the tsunami came back out, the water cried them away.
Street after street, you see rows of houses that have just been crushed and turned into rubble. When the tsunami wave hit this area, it hit with such impact that it actually changed the coastline. You know, it slammed into the coast at 800 kilometres an hour. When I was there, about 2,000 people were confirmed dead, and many of those people were buried alive under rubble for days and days after the earthquake happened. They were calling out, shouting out for help as people tried to rescue them. But unfortunately, there was so much rubble that many of those died there. And others who have had their bodies recovered were buried in mass graves to stop the spread of diseases. We've heard of entire families that have disappeared and people who are still, after all this time, searching for loved ones. And Lister, who we heard from just before, she said she lost more than 30 family and friends because of the tsunami. Driving through the area, you can really just see how Palu would be such an amazing tourist destination. And even some of our own World Vision Australia colleagues, Scott McLaughlin, he was in the area not too long ago, and this is what he had to say.
It was quite an interesting morning, grand final morning, 5:30, half asleep, listening to ABC News Radio, and I thought I heard Palu, and then Central Sulawesi, and then earthquake and tsunami, and sprang straight out of bed and turned the TV on to have it confirmed. And I was in disbelief. And Palu particularly was a city that was, I would describe it as organised chaos. A lot of colour, a lot of movement, a lot of sounds, a lot of happy people. When I was there and appreciating what was sort of unfolding around me, was little margin for error because it was pretty fragile infrastructure, a lot of people in a very small space. And I was amazed in that within that margin of error how they were getting along. This thought of them being subjected to Mother Nature in its full force was something else, to think that the margin of error wasn't there initially. What is it now? Like, the impact must be significant.
If you've seen the footage, you know how terrible the whole thing looks. But then to go there, it's just on another level. So literally almost every house in the tsunami zone was flattened and just reduced to rubble. This is an area that straddles the fault line, and they see violent tectonic movements all the time, and it can be really devastating. So I was in the car travelling with one of our local staff members named Rena. And she's lived in Palu for many, many years. And she spoke about how the area was quite beautiful and that the government's been investing in the city and that it's a really beautiful place to live. We're driving around now and we just see rubbish on the side of the road that was carried by water or by the earthquake. You get to certain sections where the road's completely split and it's really difficult to get over. And the tsunami has actually changed the shape of the shoreline.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Have you been there to see that shoreline, that touristy destination?
Yes, yes. One thing that I miss from this Palu, if you want to see the mountain, yes, you have a mountain views. If you want to see the sea, yes, you have sea views. There's a complete mountain, sea, land, Palu have everything.
Rena also told me about a 25-year-old female volunteer who was killed by the tsunami. She was running her women's economic empowerment program by the beach when the tsunami came in.
After the earthquake, of course, on 6 p.m., and 5 minutes after that, she called her colleagues and she says that I'm safe, but I'm afraid. And after that, we lost. Maybe because the network is down, electricity is down. But I do believe that she will run to the safe place. That's what I believe. You know that I'm feeling guilty because of we forget her in our prayer. Everyone that we prayed, they are safe. But after they tried to find out and looking for in a lot of camp, but could not find her, we really lost. We really lost.
So for me, I think that was one of the most difficult things to hear. Staff have to carry that grief with them, and despite everything, they're still getting up every day and they're going out to the field and they're doing whatever they can to help other people. So as you can hear, we have a couple of builders trying to repair the World Vision compound in Palu at the moment. It's about a week since the earthquake and tsunami struck, and there were 65,000 buildings damaged or destroyed during the disaster, and the World Vision compound wasn't exempt. We too lost part of our building, and we're not allowed to go inside areas because it's not safe. It could collapse at any second. So myself, along with about 20, 30 other staff members, we've been sleeping outside under some shelters. So yeah, I think like the rest of the city, just trying to rebuild at the moment. We're at that stage where we're starting to see more aid get through, and also people are starting to try to rebuild their lives. But definitely the trauma is still quite raw. The earthquake and the tsunami is still so fresh in a lot of their minds, and especially when you meet children at the child-friendly spaces that World Vision supports. You have about half of those children happy and playing and seem really, really engaged, and then you see the other 50% and many of their eyes are just glazed over, or you can tell they're a bit withdrawn, and so they're still very affected by what they've seen. You know, you were going house to house, tent to tent, by foot, trying to help staff track down the missing sponsor children. So there are about 1,800 sponsored children who are sponsored by Australians in the affected region. It's absolute chaos because people have just fled in all different directions. There are people who may have gone to stay with family in another city, in another town, with no phone or internet access, or perhaps children have been separated from their parents and are with friends or relatives in a displacement camp. And then there are other cases where we simply don't know what's happened to the children.
We are looking for Fikram, a boy who's 11.
Fikram Kilarante, anaknya
Fikram.
Namanya Pak Maharudi.
Oh, bukan di sini.
Oh, bukan di sini ya.
Okay. He's not here.
Yeah.
He's not here. Yeah. We have so far found 39 of them, but everybody has scattered. There's utter confusion. People sometimes recognise names and point us in a direction. Other times they just say, we don't know that child at all.
Yeah, so we're still looking for these sponsored children. It's going to take weeks or months, don't you think? It's not an easy process, that's for sure.
No, if we could do it in a day, we would. But the chaos and the scale of the devastation with the dispersal of people means this is perhaps going to take months to do.
So in the meantime, we just have to keep searching, I guess.
Yeah, look, if I was sponsoring a child, I would want World Vision to be telling me tomorrow, are they alive, are they safe? I sponsor kids myself and I know that emotion. But this is chaos. When disaster strikes, unlike our development situations that are stable, where you have registration and you have regular contact, this is chaos. People have run everywhere, have put up bits of tarps just wherever they can get a bit of shelter, and that's why it's often like finding a needle in a haystack.
Unfortunately, I think there are going to be cases where for many more months to come, we're still not going to know the answers. But we suspect that at least some of those children are buried under mud when a landslide hit a village called Jonooge. And pretty much we had homes and buildings that were sitting in this field, which have, because of this landslide, they've been carried about a kilometre downstream, and more mud has replaced where they are. So, I mean, those people could be anywhere.
My name's Andrew Newmarch. I'm an impact portfolio manager in World Vision Australia. World Vision has actually been in the Palu area for probably 30 plus years. And most of the activity in Indonesia is now programmed through the local World Vision called Wahana Visi. It's not so much through World Vision International. But that's a process of the Indonesian government trying to foster local indigenous NGOs doing work in Indonesia rather than relying on international agencies. We've been very fortunate in this case that we've had 1,855 children who were sponsored, and to date we've been able to account for over 1,400 of those. But there's still some of the places now, it's several weeks later, still some of those places are very inaccessible. And so we haven't been able to account for everybody. And we've found difficulties where in some villages people have gone up into the hills or gone bush to escape the effects of the earthquake, or they've gone to another city. And we still have to find those people and account for those people back to our donors. So that's quite a big process. Then we have to think about, well, what do we do with the money that people have given us? We have a process whereby we inform people that we'll put it into emergency. Then when further assessments are done, we need to think about, well, some of the places that we were in, where our children were and where we were running programs, were perhaps not as badly affected. So how do we manage the return to normal programming when that may not be the same for every space? And so there's quite a lot of decisions that need to be done, and quite sensitively, and how to communicate that effectively and transparently back to donors. So that's another aspect from my side of the business.
The hard work is just beginning. I mean, the road to recovery, it's going to take months, if not years. So it's definitely still ongoing, and the search for those missing sponsored children will continue until we've done absolutely everything we can to find those kids. We might have to accept the unfortunate fact that we'll never know what happened to some of those kids in some of those cases.
Time and again, I came across some good news stories. One woman who took 8 hours to walk 4 kilometres from where the earthquake hit her village, walking up to high land, was sure her kids had died because she could not find them. It took her that long because she was trudging through thick mud up to a metre waist high just to try to get to high ground. And with tears in her eyes, she told me with great relief that after 8 hours, she found all 3 children. They had been able, with others in the terror, to escape, and she was reunited with them. I heard many of those near escape stories triumph when people thought it was just all tragedy. So when a disaster hits, the first response is humanitarian or relief experts that World Vision have to get in, to act fast, to save lives. Any delay costs lives. But then after a month or so, you withdraw the relief workers and you introduce our development workers, who are much more culturally sensitive and understand that you're dealing with trauma and you're giving people the hope that the recovery phase, post the relief phase, is going to actually happen. It will be long term, it will take years, but you are there helping them decide if they want to rebuild their homes in an area where they can't even trust the very ground they stand on.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise O'Callaghan from World Vision Australia, and I'm going to be hosting the Yak from time to time. Right now, I thought you might be interested to learn that since making this episode, our colleagues in Indonesia, who've been working around the clock, have now located 99% of the children registered with World Vision programs in the areas affected, including Palu. Sadly, we have also confirmed that 7 of the children sponsored by Australian families have perished. As we speak, our team is continuing to work in more than 30 of the hardest hit villages, providing families with shelter, food, clean water and basic hygiene items. We've also set up safe spaces where mothers and children can receive the support to stay healthy and recover.
Thanks for listening to The Yak. I'm Tim Costello. Please subscribe via your favourite podcast app and find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at The Yak Podcast. If this is your first time listening, I recommend you go back and listen to the first episode, where we meet the people behind the Kids Off Nauru campaign. A campaign to get all children off Nauru by Universal Children's Day on Tuesday, 20th of November. If you want to donate, go to the Earthquake and Tsunami Appeal. Go to www.worldvision.com.au.